And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. It's November, or Movember, the month when men, well, at least some men, sprout hair on their top lip and grow a moustache. Now, I've been hirsute since 1971 and only shaved once since then in the hot London summer of 74. But when I did shave, I mean, I left my moustache intact and then immediately grew my beard back after my wife shrieked a cry of non-recognition when she saw me. I had not warned her. But that's another story for another time, perhaps. In case you don't know, Movember is a worthy charity founded in Australia in 2003 to help research and prevent prostate cancer and other men's health problems. In Switzerland, for example, about one man in eight will be diagnosed with prostate cancer during his lifetime. And prostate cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in Switzerland, like in America and many other Western countries, behind lung cancer. About one man in 40 will die of prostate cancer. Now, what's my interest in the subject, you might ask? Well, I had surgery for prostate cancer in 2003, at the relatively youthful age of 55. It was successful, thank God. That's why I'm here talking to you today. But my dear father died of it at the relatively young age of 63, and that was 46 years ago. And it seems that there's a family tendency towards this type of cancer in the McKay male genes. Thankfully, and as I guess we would all expect it, medical science and technology have advanced since 1976 and 2003, the two big milestones in my prostate cancer recollections. And some of you listening might remember that back in November, or Movember 2015, I interviewed my doctor, the specialist urologist surgeon who operated on me. Well, I'm pleased to say that Dr. Charles-Henri Rocha is with me again today. In fact, I'm in his Geneva office now as interviewer and not as patient. And for those of you who've never heard of him, let me give you a glimpse of his impressive credentials. He's been practicing as a doctor since 1982 and is a fellow of the European Board of Urology. Since March 1999, he's been one of the pioneers in laparoscopic surgery, practicing his first laparoscopic radical prostatectomy in Switzerland. Don't rush to Google it. I'm going to ask him to explain what laparoscopic, if I pronounced it correctly, means. He established the Multidisciplinary Center for Robot-Assisted Laparoscopic Surgery, which opened in 2003 at the Clinique Générale Beaulieu in Geneva, which is next door to where I am now. In 2013, he co-founded and directed the Swiss International Prostate Center, and we're going to talk about that center during this interview. His experience in robotics in general, and particularly in robot-assisted prostatectomy, is widely acknowledged. Under his leadership, the Clinique Générale Beaulieu has, since 2015, been one of the few institutions in Switzerland to be accredited as a host center by the European Association of Urology for training in robot-assisted radical prostatectomy using what's called the Da Vinci robot. At the same time, he's been for many years consultant in charge of urologic surgery at the Hôpital de la Chaux-de-Fonds here in Switzerland and consultant in the Department of Urology at the Geneva University Hospitals, known locally as the UG. Apart from his commitment to oncological reconstructive surgery, I have to get used to pronouncing all these unusual names for me, he's also a humanitarian, and this has led him to participate in numerous wartime missions as a surgeon. He holds the Commander's Cross of the Order Pro Merito Militensi, awarded by the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, and regular listeners will remember that recently I interviewed the Sovereign Order's ambassador to the United Nations here in Geneva. He's also a teacher and developed treatment, training, and prevention programs in the field of obstetric fistula in the Republic of Benin. These programs are now internationally recognized, and since 1996, he's been the consultant in charge of obstetric fistula surgery at the Tangueta Hospital in northern Benin in West Africa. He's a visiting associate professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Women's Health of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at the Yeshiva University in New York City. And there's much, much more I could tell you about it. But Dr. Rocha, welcome back to the McKay Interview. Many thanks for making time for me again and time for our listeners and sharing your vast knowledge and experience with us. It's much appreciated.
Hello, Mikhail. Thank you very much for the invitation. Listen to you. I think you know more about me than I know myself about me.
I'm not sure about that. But Dr. Rocha, before we begin, please briefly and in simple English, tell me and our listeners, what does laparoscopic mean and obstetric fistula, just so we know?
Yeah, of course, that's two very different things. First of all, laparoscopy, it's just surgery by using a camera, a lens inside the body. It's what we call keyhole surgery.
It's keyhole surgery, yeah. I see.
We insert some trocars inside the inflated abdomen to develop a working space. And with the camera, we can move inside the abdomen.
I see.
And with small tools, we can perform what we call mini-invasive surgery. It's a very precise movement, and we control the bleeding step by step. Otherwise, we couldn't see. So the big advantage is a small incision, very good precision of the surgery, less bleeding, less infection, better recovery.
I see. Okay. Well, now you mentioned
that's
keyhole.
Laparoscopic.
Okay.
Keyhole
now,
surgery.
Obstetric fistula. What's that in simple English?
That's something completely different. Obstetric fistula is a condition which occurs to poor women when they are not assisted for delivery, and they deliver at home without any medical or assistance. And if the baby is too big and the labor become obstructed, then the baby gets stuck in the abdomen of the woman. And the pressure of the head of the baby against the bladder, even against the rectums, destroy the tissue, and at the end, some holes appear. And that we call the fistula. It's a communication, it's a hole between the vagina and the bladder, or between the vagina and the rectum. And it's a terrible condition, which has completely disappeared in the developed countries.
It's only for poor women who can't afford the best treatment, having babies at home.
That's right. And no access to obstetric units.
Okay.
No access to C-section.
Because
the solution would be to get a cesarean section on time.
Thank you for that clarification. There may be many women listening and thinking, oh, Michael, you're so ignorant and you should know these things, but I didn't anyway. But before we get into the advances in knowledge and medical expertise over the last 40 to 50 years for men's health, please remind me and inform our listeners who might not know of the two urological cancers most common in men, testicular and prostate. What's the difference? And it would not be a guess to say that we all know what the testicles are for, but what is the prostate for and what purpose does it serve?
Okay, let me correct you about the incidence. Testicular cancer is a rare cancer. But it's true that in 2003, when they create the Movember movement, they wanted to associate testicular cancer to prostate cancer. But actually, the rate of testicular cancer is less than 500 new cases a year.
As small as that.
In Switzerland,
yeah.
Compared to over 6,000 new cases per year of prostate cancer.
So it's a big difference.
It's a big difference.
Yeah.
So testicular cancer, it's highly curable. It's concerned only the population of young men less than 40, generally.
Okay.
And it's a good prognosis. The diagnosis is made because the patient itself notices a lump, a node in the testicle. And it's good that the Movember the awareness of this kind of Movember program is to stress the men, just try sometimes to palpate your testicle. If you feel some abnormalities, then consult a doctor. That's for testicular cancer. Prostate cancer, that's a completely other story, much more frequent, much more difficult to diagnose, because you cannot palpate it so easily.
Because it's so far inside.
Yes.
Okay. And are these diseases genetic and hereditary? And if contracted, can any blame be ascribed to lifestyle, or is it just bad luck?
It's most of the time it's just bad luck. For testicular cancer, it's just bad luck. For prostate cancer, you can find prostate cancer families in a rate between 15 to 20%. If you make the anamnese, you will find a brother or father concerned also with prostate cancer. The question is frequently asked by the patients. I have a prostate cancer, my father had a prostate cancer, what to do with my kids? I have two boys. So today, the only thing we can say is we have a marker. It's not a real cancer marker, but that's the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen. And that's the only thing which is really helpful to for the early detection of prostate cancer. And so the advice, if you have prostate cancer and if you have kids, ask your kids to do the PSA test from the age of 40. But otherwise, the genetic research is interesting, but it's not. Today it doesn't have a real added value for detection or screening of prostate cancer.
But I wanted, as you mentioned PSA, I wanted to ask you, but let me ask you the question now. It seems from what I've read and from what I've heard that some doctors seem to disagree on the effectiveness of the PSA test. Is there any other alternative? And why is it that doctors seem to disagree on the effectiveness and the usefulness of the PSA test?
Originally, the PSA was not developed for screening of prostate cancer. It was the marker was developed to judge about the efficacy of a treatment of a prostate cancer. And the test has been misused for decades, and many men got an over-treatment, over-diagnosis and over-treatment. And that's the reason why many doctors are reluctant to advise prostate cancer detection.
But let me stop you there. When you say over-treatment, do you mean that the doctors gave them something which wasn't appropriate for their condition?
Absolutely. I will come straight to the point. In 2003, the European Commission did not recommend prostate cancer screening by PSA because of the risk of over-treatment and over-diagnosis. But in September 2022, last September, is a new communicate from the European Commission. And for the first time, they recommend to extend the screening program to prostate cancer with the PSA. So it has dramatically changed these last years. Why? And why do we recommend now detection program with PSA and not before? It's because today we have much better tools to appreciate the risk of the prostate cancer. I mean, having a prostate cancer detected will not mean that you will be operated or you will get radiation. we can today we have a better knowledge of the disease, and thanks to the MRI, the MRI gives a real map of the cancer in the prostate, and that helps to predict the risk of growing or of metastasis even. So that's the paradigm which has changed. We have today tools to appreciate the risk and to give a very good counseling to the patient. You should do nothing. You should do a biopsy. You should repeat biopsy. You should repeat MRI. You should be operated. You should have a focal treatment. We have, or you should have an irradiation. We have many way to treat the patients with a very good result, which was not the case maybe 10 years ago.
So just to be clear, particularly for people listening who might have a particular interest, because this is a new topic to them, and using myself as an example, just repeat again the sort of timeline. Let's say from the time, for example, when I lost my father back in 1976, yep. And what might have been available to him medically when he was in England, to 2003 when I met you and you diagnosed me, and today 2022, and then just give me a sense of the technology that's developed in medical practice since then.
At the time of your father's disease, the diagnosis of prostate cancer was only made by rectal exam, feeling a hardness on the prostate. But it was generally at the time of the patient already had symptoms, so the surgery was too late. The results were very bad, and the disease was absolutely not properly treated, except for with orchidectomy at the time when
and
the
what
patient
is it,
relapsed.
What does that mean?
We go back to the testicle, but we take the testicle out.
Oh, I
see. Because, you know, the testicle...
It's quite dramatic.
The testicle has two functions. Yeah. They produce the spermatozoide.
Yeah.
And the second function, the parallel, is like a film with two separate units of production, making the spermatozoide and making the hormones. And the hormones feed the prostate. So if you have prostate cancer, which is extended, by removing the testicle, you cut, you remove the fuel for the
So that
the
is
cancer.
A dramatic response to saving
so
the life.
So that was in the past.
Yeah, sure.
But since you have been operated in 2003, what's new? Today, all our patients have an MRI exam before. If the MRI shows something, we use the lesions described on the MRI, and we make what we call the fusion biopsy. We go straight to the abnormality. So the accuracy of the biopsy is much better. Less patients get the biopsy, and more biopsies are positive because they are really well indicated due to the MRI. That's one thing. Let's speak about the robot. You have been operated by laparoscopy, and I was one of the very few people performing this surgery 20 years ago. But at the time you have been operated, I already finished since long my learning curve, which I started in 99, and you got a good treatment. But it was a very demanding surgery, very complicated. With the robot, it's much easier. And today, in Switzerland, we are so many robotic units, so many urologists able to perform a prostatectomy with the robot, but they would not be able at all to do that without the robot.
Sorry, and it's demanding because it's more precise. I mean, sorry, the robot is better because it's more precise. Is that, or are there other reasons that the non-medical person would understand?
The three main reasons. It's first of all, the robot has articulated tools.
Right.
So with a huge degree of flexibility.
You which can, the human hand doesn't have.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can cut in right angle. And these tools have no tremor, so it's a high, very high precision tool. Second advantage with the robot, you have a real 3D vision.
Ah, yes.
Which is a huge difference. The 3D compared to the 2D we had with the conventional laparoscopy is a huge difference. And third advantage, with the robot, you work in a very ergonomic position. You sit with your arms, you work with a joystick, you can use the two hands in the same way. You have no dominant.
So it's more efficient.
It's more efficient.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic development.
Yeah.
And also one very important development in 20 years is the new imaging, like the PET scan. And we have a specific PET scan now for prostate cancer.
What does that do?
It's called the PSMA.
PSMA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's specific for prostate cancer. And that's very important to, before or after treatment, to assess the real situation of the patient in terms of risk of metastasis. Node, lymph node metastasis or bone metastasis. So before or after surgery, the PET scan is a very, very useful tool. New development also is in terms of radiotherapy, which is today much more precise, like surgical radiotherapy due to the new machine. In terms of medicine, we have also new drugs. It's called the new generation hormonal treatment, which is very efficient. So in the last 20 years, really, it's a huge change, it's a huge improvement.
So it's quite a dramatic, and from what you say, it's not been incremental, but some of these changes, these improvements have been quite pronounced, quite dramatic.
What has been incremental is the change of the profile of a patient. By example, I published last year a series of around 1,000 patients, even a little bit more, which I operate since in the last 15 years. And I wanted to demonstrate that the patient we operate today are not the same we operate 15 years ago.
And in what way are they different?
At the time, we didn't had the MRI, and so we didn't have the so clear information about the risk, and we were operating patients with less aggressive cancers than today. It was a little place at the time for what we call active surveillance. You have a cancer, we don't do anything now, we just observe, and we hope to be on time if something happened to treat you properly. So it was difficult to tell the patient you don't take any risk, because we didn't have at the time the proper tools to assess the risk. Today we have it. So today we operate less low-risk patient, but more high-risk patient, and we propose active surveillance or even, that's the new development, focal treatment.
I see.
If we notice a small lesion on the MRI, we make the biopsy on the target, and we notice that the cancer cells are not very aggressive. Let's try to do a focal treatment and not a radical treatment. And that's what is that the people should know, that today we can really make an à la carte treatment. It's a very, it's a very individual approach. Mm. And that is the main change. compared to the past.
For those tuning in late, my guest today is Dr. Charles Henry Rocha, the prominent Geneva urologist, and we're talking about men's health in this month of Movember. I've just got a couple more questions I wanted to ask you, Dr. Rocha. First of all, it may sound like an odd question, but you're the best person to ask. What should men do personally and individually to take better care of themselves?
But, you know, the recommendation now seems to be clear. The way of life is important for many things. Don't overeat, do some sport, don't drink too much alcohol, do not smoke too much. You know, all these recommendations are very, very useful for heart disease, for all kind of cancer, for the articulation. Having a good health is something obvious to me because, you know, I'm doing a lot of sport. I'm fit and I try to tell my patient to do the same, to move. Not only Movember, but just move.
12 months of the year,
yes.
good advice. And when I entered your office recently, because I hadn't noticed it before when I was last here a few years ago, I noticed a sign which said Swiss International Prostate Center. What is that?
Yeah, we decided to create a center, which was, the idea was to have a group of experts, but not only urologists, but radiologists and pathologists. Because I told you that today we work a lot with the MRI or the PET CT. We do biopsies, or the specimen of prostate we remove are carefully completely, very deeply and carefully examined. And we make a correlation always between the pre-op imaging in terms of MRI and the post-operative, the pathology specimen. We work in a team, and that's the reason we create the Swiss International Prostate Center. It's many urologists, pathologists, radiologists, and we have also international consultant. As today, it's very easy to with the internet and the visio to work with other colleagues. And we incorporate, of course, in this SEPC, the focal treatment. So we have all our own specificity, and we organize weekly tumor boards where we discuss the cases, and we try to give the best recommendation to our patients.
Okay, that's good to know. So it's a drawing together all this expertise into one place.
Definitely, right? Yes.
I've got two more questions for you. One, in my family, my extended family, I've got three grandsons, and I've got great nephews as well. So there are quite a few boys in the McKay family. Is there a troublesome gene that gives rise to prostate cancer? And if the answer is yes, can genetic science eliminate that gene so that when my grandsons are 40, they won't have to go through the hassle that I have had to go through?
That would be the future, hopefully, for all the kind of cancer, to be able to interfere with the genes. Today, again, it doesn't have a real added value. We ask sometimes for genetic counseling.
Genetic?
Counseling.
So what does that mean?
We send patients to the genetician.
Yeah, yeah.
And they
counseling, sorry.
Counseling.
I misunderstood you, yeah.
Counseling, sorry.
Yeah.
And so they try to do a mapping of the genes.
Yes, I understand.
They see if something abnormal. But clinically, for the prostate cancer today, that doesn't help. So PSA is the best recommendation. But also the rectal exam, so, 20% of prostate cancer do not make PSA. And the diagnosis is done just by rectal exam.
So it's quite a big percentage.
Yes. Yeah. If you do not do the rectal exam to your patients, you will miss 20% of prostate cancer.
Gosh.
So from the age of 40, your son, by example, should have yearly PSA determination.
I'm sure they're listening. Yeah, my nephews as well.
And don't avoid the rectal exam.
Yeah. Last question, because this is essentially not just about men, it's about families as well. Tell me, in your many years of medical experience, you must have had contact with many different family members, not just fathers or husbands or male partners. What, in your experience, can women, whether wives, life partners, daughters, granddaughters, do in the quest to improve their men's health?
One thing, the women, the daughter, the mother are very, very concerned when prostate cancer appears in the family. And that's also the reason I have to sit in my office. I'm always very happy to meet the wife of the mother or whatever, or the friend of the patient to discuss together. Because the family has a very important role to support the patient, to encourage him, and the prostate cancer is something to be shared with the close relatives.
Because the taboo subject, particularly for men, is impotence and incontinence.
Yes.
And this can be a consequence, a result of the surgery.
Absolutely. And, erection dysfunction is a problem inside the couple. So it has been discussed with the couple before and after surgery. So it's, and we have many solutions, but the solution has to be exposed to the power, to the two persons. We have actually very good result in terms of surgery now quality of surgery and recovering of erection. Incontinence is very rare. It's concerned less than 3% of the patient, and we also have solution, but the patients fear about that. So it's good to discuss that with the relative.
Mm.
I think it was in Japan. I never saw the advertisement, but a friend told me to make an awareness campaign for prostate cancer. It was a woman on the affiche. It was a woman, and she said, "I have a prostate cancer."
Really?
Yeah. That means I have a prostate cancer in my family.
Yeah.
It was a.
And that was a Japanese advertising campaign.
It was very nice.
Yeah,
it was a good idea.
Yeah.
Just to say that the woman is very concerned, or the friend, and it has to be part of the discussion and of the treatment.
Dr. Rocha, thanks so much for answering all my questions so precisely and with such care and sensitivity. I really do appreciate that, and I hope those listening have found it useful. I certainly have found it useful, although I've lived with it for the last 20 years. My guest today has been Dr. Charles Henry Rocha, the well-known Geneva urologist. Thanks again, Doctor.
Thank you to you, Michael.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.